Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's announcement by the Secretary of Defence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs allowing women in the military to soon serve in combat. A former sergeant and Arabic-speaking intelligence specialist who served with the 101st Airborne Division in Iraq, Kayla Williams, joins us. The author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, she will tell us how she feels about what President Obama calls an historic step. Then, with today's news of the impending resignation of Assistant Attorney General Lanny Brewer and the nomination of Mary Jo White to head up the Securities and Exchange Commission, we will speak with Martin Smith, the producer of the just-broadcast PBS Frontline special The Untouchables, which is about the failure of the Justice Department to prosecute those responsible for the 2008 financial meltdown that caused the recession and the impoverishment of millions of Americans. Then finally, we'll examine the latest explicit threat from North Korea against the United States with the announcement that they will soon conduct a bigger nuclear test in defiance of the United Nations Security Council sanctions imposed in response to a recent North Korean missile test. Sung Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss the meaning and motives behind Pyongyang's heated rhetoric. And joining us now is Kayla Williams, who was a former sergeant and Arabic linguist in a military intelligence company of the 101st Airborne Division. During her deployment to Iraq, Williams was at the forefront of troop interaction with Iraqis and also navigated the challenges of being part of the 15% of the army that is female. Kayla is the author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, a memoir about her experiences negotiating the challenging demands of today's military. Kayla is a Truman National Security Project Fellow and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. She currently lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband, a combat wounded veteran, and their two young children. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kayla Williams.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the announcement today by the Secretary of Defense and by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs that women are now able to be in combat is a little bit, at least it sounds a little bit like the horse is down the paddock and the barn door is open. Haven't women already been in combat?
We have been serving in combat for a little over a decade now. However, we have been banned from combat arms jobs, such as the infantry, the artillery, armor, and from combat arms units at below the brigade level. So this momentous change does formalize what you say has been the boots on the ground reality that women have been in combat, but also tremendously expands the numbers of positions and roles that we can fill.
And of course, I've interviewed before Tammy Duckworth, who's now in the Congress, who lost her legs in Iraq. Nobody could suggest that she wasn't in combat.
Exactly, but she was a pilot, not an infantryman.
But there are women pilots also in serving in Apache helicopters, etc., in combat in Afghanistan as we speak.
Absolutely. Women have been fighter pilots and are now also serving on nuclear submarines. So this is a major change when it comes to serving in ground combat positions and ground combat units, one that really, in my opinion, validates the honorable service that so many of us have engaged in over the past decade.
So a lot of our listeners are on the liberal side of the political spectrum, and they might be wondering why women should be celebrating being able to kill their fellow humans.
I believe this is a tremendous step forward for full equality. Those who have actually been to combat, I think, are in many ways less likely to advocate the use of force and going to war than others, because we have seen how horrific combat can actually be. But in terms of advancing women's position in society, many of us truly desire to be able to serve the nation that we are citizens of. It is an important part of taking part in the civic process. And I would urge all of those who believe that our military should not be used as vigorously to participate fully in the democratic process and encourage their elected officials to be judicious in choosing which conflicts they decide to send our military to.
Again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, who was a former sergeant and Arabic linguist in a military intelligence company of the 101st Airborne Division, and she was deployed in Iraq and was at the forefront of troops' interaction with Iraqis and also navigated the challenge of being part of the 15% of the army that is female, and is the author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. So is this then really about job descriptions and job fairness and pay equity as much as anything else?
Those are all very important parts of the issue. I also believe that the former policy, the policy that's just now ending, that excluded women from these combat arms positions, it really made women in the military second-class citizens. And that, I believe, contributed to a climate that tacitly encouraged sexual harassment and allowed sexual assault to flourish. It is my belief that by making very clear to all troops that women are equal, that we are full soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, that we do not exist in separate but equal roles in any way, that we truly are troops like all others, that it will help to change that climate and make the military a better place for women to serve.
Well, Kelly Williams, there's certainly a lot of evidence, and there was just a general officer who's just put on trial for a rape in Afghanistan, raping a female subordinate. And I've spoken to a number of women veterans who have been raped in the military and have had a hard time getting justice and cracking the kind of boys' club of either, you know, indifference or cover-up. So explain to our audience how making women equal in terms of being able to engage in combat, how that will make a difference with the mentality of the men in the military who, I mean, my interpretation is from what you're saying is perhaps they think that because you aren't in combat, you're there as sort of some kind of decoration or comfort. I mean, explain it to me better than I'm trying to get my head around it.
I may not go quite that far, but yeah, so far women have served in combat support and combat service support roles. When I was sexually harassed in the military and complained about it to my peers, many of the men that I served with responded by saying things along the lines of, you shouldn't report it and ruin some man's career just because you can't take it. And that feeling from my peer group that men's careers in the military were automatically more important than my career in the military, that's at the heart of what I'm trying to explain. That the perception was they were in, these men, they're combat arms, they're real soldiers, and here I am, I'm just a woman, I didn't really fully belong there, and I shouldn't cause problems and make waves because I couldn't take it. I believe that once women are seen more fully as sisters in arms, as being full participants in the military, that that attitude over time will become less acceptable, and it will start to make a dent in the long run in those unacceptably high rates of sexual harassment and assault.
So what do you make of some of the resistance that still is there? There was criticism of today's announcement by the Secretary of Defense and by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, for example, from Senator James Imhoff, Republican of Oklahoma, and he's a leading Republican on the Armed Services Committee. And he said that it raises serious practical barriers that, if ignored, could jeopardize the safety and privacy of service members. We've heard similar arguments about gays in the military, about how it affects combat readiness and performance, that women are some kind of distraction. Address all of those criticisms, if you will, Kayla.
If I may be frank, I just find that silly. I think it disregards the reality of today's experiences. Women are already there. They're already in those situations as medics, as military police, as supply sergeants, as helicopter pilots, as military intelligence personnel. We are already there. We are already in foxholes. We are already in tents. We're already alongside our male comrades in Humvees and on helicopters and in planes. So, as was also true with gay personnel before the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, many of the same people who are now speaking out against further equality for women in the military were the ones who predicted dire consequences from the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They've been proven tremendously wrong on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which has gone off without problems, and I believe that they will be proven just as wrong about the coming changes of women's positions in the military.
And again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, a former sergeant and Arabic linguist in a military intelligence company of the 101st Airborne Division, who served in Iraq and navigated the challenge of being part of the 15% of the army that is female, and is the author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. I was just recently on vacation at a wedding in Australia, and I happened to be sitting next to a woman, and we got chatting, and she turned out that she was the first female captain of a warship in the Australian Navy in combat, both in Timor and in Iraq. And I was pretty impressed with this woman because,
absolutely,
you know, she was the commander of a ship and had hundreds of men under her command and had been in combat. And, of course, you know, Iraq and Timor was some time ago. So the impression I have is that the U.S. is really behind a lot of other countries in this regard.
Certainly some other countries, that is true. And within the U.S. military, there are changes between the services. Women have been allowed to serve on nuclear submarines for, I think, a couple years now. Women have been allowed to be fighter pilots in the Air Force for quite a few years. And it's really the ground combat services, the Army and the Marine Corps, that have been a little behind. And indeed, we are behind Australia. My belief is that the United States will probably be looking at Australia's model of implementing the elimination of the combat exclusion policy for ground forces. Australia is just getting started with that implementation this year as well. They expect it to be a 3-year process wrapping up in 2016. And from what I've seen so far, that looks like that's going to be the case here in the U.S. as well.
So specifically, what the Pentagon is announcing here is it would open up about 14,000 combat-related positions to female troops, but an estimated 238,000 other jobs, about one-fifth of the regular active duty military, were kept off-limit by women, have been kept off-limit, right?
Right. Those 14,000 were opened up about a year ago as, I believe, a type of pilot to see how this would work out, and that, from what I understand from the press conference earlier today, that went well, and they've decided to go ahead and make these additional changes. The big change now is that instead of the Department of Defense prohibiting by regulation women from serving in combat jobs and combat units at smaller sizes, now the burden is going to be on the military services to argue that women should still be prevented from serving in particular jobs. They have a few months to make their arguments, if they choose to do so, about which, if any, jobs they believe should still be closed to women. There's certainly a chance that the Army and Marine Corps will say that, for example, special forces jobs should still be off limits to women. So there are a lot of specific details still to be worked out in terms of the implementation, what the specific standards will be for some of these jobs as they get open. And it's going to be really interesting to see how things go as we move forward over the next few months.
But Kayla Williams, my understanding is that women are necessary in, and I assume this applies to both special forces and intelligence units, because they're pretty much at the tip of the spear in the current deployments in Afghanistan, for example. And even though we're reducing our somewhat unwelcome footprint in Islamic lands, you probably had firsthand experience of having to deal with Iraqi women because of religious strictures. You know, men can't pat down Muslim women. So give us a sense of the roles that you've played in the past and the kind of interactions you've had.
You're absolutely right. Women, female soldiers have an absolutely vital role to play in counterinsurgency operations that are a key component of which is trying to win the hearts and minds of the local populations, especially in Muslim countries where it is more challenging for local women to feel free speaking to male soldiers. So we can be absolutely vital components of that struggle. And I think we've been playing those roles already. We've been in those positions alongside special forces already. Again, we've been attached and not assigned to those units, and that may continue to be the case. Really, we have yet to see what the services are going to decide to push for.
So just tell us a little bit about your personal experience as an Army intelligence specialist in Iraq. And there aren't too many Arabic speakers, at least in the early part of the Iraq war, there wasn't. Presumably they've improved the numbers considerably by now, but you must have been pretty valuable.
Yes, I was actually trained to do signals intelligence, but when we invaded Iraq, there was a much stronger need for me to serve as an interpreter, and so I did go out on combat foot patrols with the infantry in Baghdad. I was able to translate between infantry troops and the local population. It was one of the most fulfilling parts of my military career because I could see that I was making a difference in helping to provide communication between these two groups.
So what did your fellow male soldiers think of you? And how did they treat you?
During major combat operations, when I was going out on combat foot patrols with the infantry in Baghdad, the only thing that mattered to them was that I spoke Arabic. It was absolutely the only thing that they cared about. When I would run into them months later, they would say, "Oh, hey, you're our linguist in Baghdad." That was what mattered to them. When major combat operations were over and the tempo of operations slowed down, people had more time on their hands and were bored, things became more challenging and instances of sexual harassment did take place. But during those major combat operations, my ability to help them accomplish the mission was the only thing that mattered.
But the fact that you did that didn't count as much as it would if you were a male.
I would not say that. I know that there have been women who
in
have
terms
not been
of, in
able
terms
to get
of a career.
Certain awards.
Right.
But for me, I was recognized for what I did and felt honored and valued for my ability to help accomplish the mission.
But in terms of a career path, the impression I get is that this rule change today levels the playing field in terms of a career path.
Right, I think that's absolutely true. It's more so for officers, but it's very important that women will now be able to go to some of the schools that they've been banned from so far, such as Ranger School. That certainly makes people far more competitive when it comes to promotions.
I see. So, well, just in closing, Kayla Williams, I guess you're feeling happy about this. I mean, that's...
I am. If I can be a tiny bit cheesy, listening to President Obama's inaugural address on Monday when he mentioned from Seneca to Selma to Stonewall, talking about the march of equality, I thought it was great. I immediately thought of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and what tremendous progress has been made, but I did not expect an announcement this momentous, this soon, on women's rights, women's equality. To me, it's a real fulfillment of that promise and a vindication of the service of so many of our women throughout this nation's history.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kayla Williams.
Thank you, and have a great evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Kayla Williams, who's a former sergeant and Arabic linguist in a military intelligence company of the 101st Airborne Division. During her deployment to Iraq, she was at the forefront of troops' interaction with Iraqis while also navigating the challenges of being part of the 15% of the army that is female. Kayla is the author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, a memoir about her experiences negotiating the changing demands of today's military. And she is a Truman National Security Project Fellow and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women's Veterans. And she currently lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband, a combat wounded veteran, and their two young children. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the producer and correspondent of the Explosive Frontline special, Exposing the Untouchables on Wall Street.
To be a woman and to be turned down, old enough now to change your name, when so many love you, is it the It's the woman in you that makes you wanna play this game.
I'm getting my money the fastest. Memos and faxes, shredded up documents. Slush funds through the corrupt continents. But they don't want me indicted, cause they don't want my dirty laundry aired when I fight it. Don't get my lawyers excited, cause what good is a law if you can't rewrite it? I got CIA traitors, dictators, so fuck y'all whistleblowers and haters.
I am the 1%.
Got in the ocean coasting with the sails out. Hey, America, thanks for the bailouts. I made off at the Banco Ambrosiano. Got away scot-free like El Vaticano.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Martin Smith, the producer and correspondent of the just broadcast PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables. In his 28 years producing for Frontline, Martin Smith has covered the world from revolutions in Central America and the fall of communism in Russia to the rise of Al-Qaeda, the war in Iraq, and Wall Street. Smith produced the award-winning trilogy for Frontline, In Search of Al-Qaeda, Return of the Taliban, and Obama's War. Smith also made several business films for Frontline, including Heat, about business and climate change, The Madoff Affair, and the landmark economy miniseries Money, Power, and Wall Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Smith.
Ian, thank you very much for having me.
And your special, The Untouchables, appears to have had some effect. I'm not sure of the cause and effect here, but Lenny Brewer, who does not come across well in your film, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of prosecuting Wall Street crimes, he hasn't announced his retirement, but the rumor is he's heading for the door.
Mm-hmm. Let me say, first of all, the reaction to the program has been immense. It's clearly struck a nerve, and a lot of people are ready to make causation out of coincidence. I can't say that I know why he's retiring at this time, but it has been known for some time that he was going to leave Justice. He's been a long-serving chief of the criminal division there, and even when I interviewed him, I brought the subject up, and he was a bit coy about it, but there was every indication that he would be going back into the private sector. But it really seems that if it's coincidence, which I tend to want to believe it is, it's simply a very awkward and mismanaged coincidence. When the interview was done, there was some tension in the interview, of course, because I was doing my job and he was doing his, and we sat on facing each other, and when it was done, I don't think anybody that was there would have thought that it was an easy go of it. So they knew the program was coming out, and in fact, we invited their comments. And why he chose, or why the Washington Post, perhaps the Washington Post simply wanted to run some old rumors that had been circulating, and for the hell of it, time it to coincide with the program. But they didn't mention the program. So I don't really like to get into speculation. I like to deal in the realm of facts, but that's what I know.
Well, but when you say that you were doing your job and he was doing his job, it strikes me as that's an ironic comment, given that the whole thrust of your PBS special that was broadcast on Tuesday, The Untouchables, was that Lenny Brewer hasn't been doing his job and that nobody has been prosecuted.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That nobody's been prosecuted. I mean, that one hopes that you have revived the outrage that's out there about this extraordinary fact that virtually the people who brought the entire global economy to a near-death experience and essentially created this recession and were bailed out by trillions of dollars of essentially wasted money have, in fact, prospered while the rest of the country has languished.
That's right. Well, what I meant was at that moment he was doing his job in that he was doing his best to answer the questions that I asked him. Clearly, the thrust of the program, as you say, was what was the Justice Department doing for the last 4 years, and have they really made a sufficient effort to prosecute those that whose activities led to the crisis? So you make a good point there.
So is there a further coincidence that today the president nominated former federal prosecutor Mary Jo White to lead up the Securities and Exchange Commission? Can you take credit for that?
I don't want to be in the position of gloating and taking credit for anything that I don't when I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. We're still reporting this and trying to discover what we can about why the events of the last couple of days are unfolding as they are. But as far as I know, I know that from one source that Brewer announced last week that he was going to have a party at his home and make some. I don't know what he said about the party, but it's not. We're not in the holidays, and one could speculate there. And again, it's a speculation that he was going to be announcing something, and I don't know when that party took place or if it hasn't yet. That's as much as we know at this point in time.
Well, the president, in announcing his nomination of former federal prosecutor Mary Jo White to lead up the Securities and Exchange Commission, did talk about the need to protect investors on Wall Street from the kind of reckless and profligate behavior that led to the crash and led to the recession and led to the bailout. And I just wonder, given that it's taken so long, one of the great questions out there in the first Obama term is, why didn't the president make an issue out of what had just happened to the country? And in a paradoxical way, it was the Tea Party, this sort of faux right-wing populist group, that seized on the bailout and on Wall Street's crash. And that was the genesis of that. And that would have been an issue that one would have thought that the left could have picked up and used, and the Democrats, but they didn't. So is that always, that's always puzzled me.
Sure. But we have short memories, all of us. The president gave mixed messages in 2009 when he came to office. He had the bankers, he had the 13 bankers meeting at the White House where bankers came fearful that he was going to crack down on them. And then he more or less told them that he stood between them and the pitchforks and that he wanted to work with them and move forward and not look back. Not too many weeks after that, he signed the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act, which would strengthen America's fraud statutes and make it easier for prosecutors to go after the banks. So there was a mixed message there. Perhaps you're trying to save the economy by saving the banks. At the same time, it's reasonable that you could be trying to prosecute and create deterrence for future bad behavior. Then in later that year, the Justice Department announced it was going to have a task force to look into mortgage fraud that Holder announced. And then again, perhaps in reaction to both Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street demonstrations and the fact that it was an election year, in January of 2012, in the President's State of the Union address, he announced the formation of a new working group to look specifically at mortgage securitization fraud. So putting Mary Jo White in charge is a move that I think a lot of people will applaud. But there have been other announcements, formations of task forces, working groups. You know, it seems to roll on. We're still waiting to see if the amount, if real prosecutions result from it.
Again, I'm speaking with Martin Smith, the producer and correspondent for the Just Broadcast PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables. He's also made a number of Frontline specials on Wall Street and the business community, including Heat about business and climate change, The Madoff Affair, and the landmark economy miniseries, Money, Power, and Wall Street. But your film, though, I mean, the reason that Lanny Brewer, we're talking about him, is that he's so much a part of your film because he's the man in charge of bringing forth prosecutions. And he did not equip himself well. I think that's putting it politely. And to this moment, I still don't understand this peculiar torpor within the Justice Department. Why all of these excuses but no action? It's mystifying. And I imagine, and I know you were trying to get to the bottom of it. Is this still a mystery?
Well, I think that there was a preference for prosecuting cases that they had more certainty they were going to win. It's the equivalent of swinging only at very slow pitches. The harder cases, I think everybody would agree that the transactions that took place, the securitization, the mortgage-backed securities, the CDO market, these were well-lawyered transactions. On the other hand, there's clear evidence that the banks knowingly and intentionally defrauded the investors. Many of those investors are Main Street through the pension funds that invested in these instruments. So it is somewhat of a mystery, but as Brewer told me, it's hard. That was the excuse he gave for why the Justice Department has not pursued these. We know that after the Bear Stearns hedge fund managers case in 2009, that was a case that was started under the Bush administration, the Justice Department lost. And I think that that may have had an effect, although Brewer says it didn't. There's one clue in that when I asked him about a speech he made before the New York City Bar Association, where he said that he lost sleep at night worrying about the consequences of indicting a bank as a financial institution, and what the consequences would be if the bank then went out of business, people lost their jobs, and there were ripple effects throughout the economy. Well, I don't think that's the job of a prosecutor. I think a lot of people would agree that the prosecutor has to pursue justice and let others worry about the consequences and not be tempered by politics or other concerns. So that shows a kind of reticence that gave us a clue into the way he thinks about these things.
Well, of course, Martin Smith, the fact that it's so difficult to understand how the untouchables got away with it, when there is such manifest paper trails, your Frontline special makes it clear that all of this stuff is on paper, all these mortgages, and you saw boxes and boxes of them. So there's this absolutely overwhelming paper trail. And the fact that so many people in these big banks and people like John Paulson and others were taking short positions with the inside knowledge, or the knowledge, shall we say, that this whole thing was going to collapse, isn't that in itself evidence?
Yes, it's mind-boggling. But, of course, you know, it's not illegal for me to sell you a bunch of crap if I tell you basically in the fine print that what I'm selling you is a bunch of crap. And there were also a lot of these arrangements whereby the buyer really didn't have visibility into the quality of these things. And so you've had a long process of discovery to ferret out just what was being sold. In the case of the insurers who insured the quality of these loan packages, they're the first to really have visibility into what was going on in these packages. And when you read those contracts, the language is pretty clear that it says that some of these loans may be defective or may not meet our standards. But, of course, some of these does not cover defect rates upwards of 50, 60, 70%. And that's where the banks are in trouble. That's where the banks have been facing a lot of civil lawsuits, and where the New York Attorney General is now acting. The U.S. Attorney in New York, Preet Bharara, is also acting on this front, and the FHFA. These are all civil suits. It's still a mystery why that evidence, if it's so damning and the banks have been forced to pay settlements in the billions of dollars, why in all of that mess there has not been one single banker held criminally liable for misrepresentations.
Well, in the film, in your film, Martin Smith, The Untouchables, the PBS Frontline special broadcast this week, and presumably will be broadcast again, and I believe it's available online at what's the website, Frontline?
Frontline.org.
So you have a whistleblower in there from Citicorp who early before the meltdown had sent memos up to the top people, including former Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin, and they were ignored. And then you show clips of Rubin's testimony where he was challenged by Senator Levin about the fact that he got these memos, and he claimed he didn't see them, and he wasn't very convincing. So I guess the question is, why was he not concerned about the bubble bursting? Because they were taken down. Did he know that the taxpayer was going to bail them out? I mean, Help me out here.
Well, what he knew, I can't tell you what he knew. Citicorp also says, and Rubin says, that actions were taken. However, in 2012, Citibank had to admit wrongdoing for failing to do due diligence when another vice president named Sherry Hunt came forward with making the same claims. In fact, she worked with Bowen, making the same claims. And the bank paid $150-some million dollars in penalties for that. And that's not a lot of money, but it was a big settlement for the bank at the time when compared to others. And the fact is they admitted that they had failed to do adequate due diligence. It's, I mean, again, that only adds to the frustration that everyone feels that if that's the case, if they failed to do due diligence and they were being warned since 2006, a la Bowen, why more wasn't done to revise their internal controls. And why, given Sarbanes-Oxley legislation that's in place that demands that the bank have good internal controls in place, why no one was held accountable?
Well, this, I think actually it's more serious now than it was then, in a sense, isn't it, Martin Smith, that we don't have the money to bail them out the next time. This cost something upwards of $21 trillion. It's one of the figures that I'd heard. So we simply don't have that. And now you have, of course, this focus on deficits and the sky is falling and these arguments over austerity going on in Washington. So you would think that there would be a real impetus here to prevent this from happening again. And my understanding is that
sure.
They're too bigger to fail. They're not just too big to fail. They're too bigger to fail now. And there is no systemic early warning system.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what I don't think that prosecution of past crimes is, I mean, that should deter future bad behavior. But even more important in the instance, in what you're talking about would be capital levels be raised and other more aggressive regulation be put in place. And that's, of course, what Dodd-Frank intends to put in place, and there's a great battle still going on between the bank lobby and legislators and the regulatory agencies over just how that's going to work out. But you're right. We're in a more fragile position than we were 4 or 5 years ago.
So in the absence of clarity, and your documentary, Martin Smith's The Untouchables on Frontline, has given us as much clarity than anybody has. And prior to you, Charles Ferguson, and in fact, he made a call at the Academy Awards and pointed out that nobody had gone to jail. To the conspiratorial mind, you're left thinking, well, somebody must have put the fix in here. It couldn't have just been Lanny Breuer, because if it's true that he's blocking up the works or whatever the right analogy is, maybe he's taking orders from somebody. It's very troubling to try and get to the bottom of it if it's not just human error, if there's other mendacious explanations. Is that, I know you deal in facts, not in conspiracy, but I
try to, but you have to know where to sniff things out, I suppose. And I, you know, you're raising good issue, you know, points that we discussed at great length in the making of the documentary and the reporting we did, and certainly we heard lots of stories. Some of them didn't check, a lot of them didn't check out, people making claims of calls from the White House to the Justice Department and whatnot, but a lot of it was not substantial. On the other hand, there was clearly a message being given late 2008 into 2009 when the Bush administration began the process of the bailouts, and that was continued into the Obama administration and the stimulus money and whatnot. There was an atmosphere of going forward, not backwards. I think at one point Geithner had said that he didn't believe in Old Testament justice. And of course, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, the president met with bankers And essentially reassured them that he was going to be on the on their side. If they would cooperate with him, he would help them out. So all of that goes to an atmosphere where prosecutors may not be getting all the political support they would like. And that by that I mean U.S. attorneys around the country and prosecutors working at lower levels than Lanny Breuer in the Justice Department. But again, that's speculation. Certainly individual prosecutors, I don't think they're sitting there trying to make nice for banks so they can get cushy jobs. I hear that all the time. I think, in fact, it would be a great notch in your belt to be able to bring down a banker if you're a prosecutor in the Justice Department. The real question is, they're operating in a political atmosphere. What kind of support did they have? Were they able to get greenlit? And you get some clue in the documentary from Kevin Perkins at the FBI, Financial Crimes Division, where he says that he argued with Lanny Breuer and was frustrated by the lack of a prosecution going forward. So you get some sense from him that it wasn't... it wasn't always his choice to put on the brakes.
Well, just in closing, obviously, a lot of people are happy to see Lanny Breuer go, not the least among them the House Oversight Committee Chairman Darrell Issa, who conducted the fast and furious and somewhat bogus investigation that he did compared to the real crimes that took place on Wall Street that have gone unpunished. What is your sense of, is there any contrition in Wall Street? Is there any understanding of what they've done and how much the Main Street has bailed them out and how they've flourished and Main Street is languishing?
That's a good question. And I you know, first of all, I don't think all bankers on Wall Street were committing criminal fraud. I think, though, when you put so much bonus money on the table, that's an incentive to cheat. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't know. I can't make a general statement about whether Wall Street feels contrition. I think that there are individuals who have expressed that to me, certainly. But, you know, where there's a lot of money, there's going to be greed, and where there's greed, there's going to be crime.
Without punishment, apparently.
It looks that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Martin Smith. And
well,
congratulations on your film. It was very, very powerful and very effective.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Martin Smith, who's the producer and correspondent of the just-produced PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables. In his 28 years producing for Frontline, Martin Smith has covered the world from revolutions in Central America and the fall of communism in Russia to the rise of Al-Qaeda and the war in Iraq and Wall Street. Smith produced the award-winning trilogy for Frontline, In Search of Al-Qaeda, Return of the Taliban, and Obama's War, and he also made several business films for Frontline, including Heat, about business and climate change, The Madoff Affair, and the landmark economy miniseries Money, Power, and Wall Street. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about North Korea's latest threat to let off an even bigger nuclear test.
Us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Sung Yun Moon Lee, Sung Yun Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung Yun Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems that the bluster coming from North Korea now is somewhat different, in as much as these are explicit threats against the United States. In a statement from the North Korean National Defense Commission, which is the country's highest military leadership, the statement coming from them is, "We do not hide that a variety of satellites and long-range rockets which will be launched by the DPRK one after another, and a nuclear test of higher level will target against the United States, the sworn enemy of the Korean people." Does this strike you as something different?
Well, in terms of their typical bluster and broad, it might, as usual, it is different in that, as we saw last month in mid-December, North Korea has apparently improve its ballistic missile technology for the first time ever since they first tried it, firing off a long-range missile for the first time in 1998. They were quite successful for the first time. So that is progress, and that is serving. It's a concern to the United States. North Korea at this point in early 2013 to make such an explicit threat against the United States, I would say, indicates that the regime is serious about conducting another missile test or even a nuclear test very soon, the coming week. And the reason for that would be, in 2012, leadership transition in all the major capitals of the North Pacific. President Obama, of course, was reelected. The North Korean leader, the current one, over in the wake of his father's death. In late 2011, we had two elections, South Korea and Japan, last month, and earlier last year, Putin made his reemergence. So what this indicates is that for the North Korean leader, the other powers, the other leaders in the other capitals of the North Pacific region would be more appeasement prone. That is, they would be preoccupied with domestic issues and would be unwilling to escalate tension with North Korea. And this is an opportunity for North Korea to cause problems, to export insecurity with the view toward bigger blandishment, more economic concessions to raise stakes.
So, I mean, there's certainly been a pattern for some time, Sung Yun Lee, of North Korea expecting to be rewarded for bad behavior. And occasionally they've succeeded in being rewarded for bad behavior. But when they recently let off their most recent missile test, after one failed, the more recent successful one, the United Nations Security Council imposed sanctions on them. And that was just a couple of days ago. So that is, it's hard not to see this latest outburst as a response to that.
Well, yes, there are, of course, already in place and even newer or more strictly enforced sanctions passed just a couple of days ago within the United Nations. But consider the past 20 years of North Korea's nuclear blackmail or nuclear diplomacy, right? You see that North Korea has reaped literally tens of billions of dollars from the U.S. and South Korea alone, on record at least $11 billion in aid. And that speaks to some kind of success, I guess, achievement on the part of the region. We know North Korea is a dependent. It is one of the poorest countries in the world. Yet, by creating problems, the neighbors in the region have been willing to ply North Korea with all kinds of blandishments, including cash. And after a decent info, some rhetorical condemnation, UN sanctions passed, all powers in the past have gone back to rewarding North Korea, to resorting to crisis management or damage control diplomacy. So the prospects, I would say, from the North Korean perspective, are quite good to repeat this pattern.
Well, let us call you right back because the phone is breaking up, and we will do that as quickly as we can so we won't miss talking with you, Sung-Yun Lee. We'll hang up right now and call you immediately back. Again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yun Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University. And we're talking about the explicit threat from North Korea against the United States with the announcement that they will soon conduct a bigger nuclear test that will target against the United States, the sworn enemy of the Korean people. And we are hoping to get a better line this time. Sung-Yun Lee, given that this pattern has apparently worked, but the fact that China joined in these additional sanctions that were just enacted by the UN Security Council on Tuesday, I believe, and which appear to have created this belligerent response from North Korea, my understanding would be that they will be going through a period of austerity, shall we say. What is the situation vis-a-vis the harvests and the amount of food? First of all, this is all coming as a surprise to Korea watchers because they thought this new young leader might be liberalizing a little because he danced with the... He has a young wife and had Mickey Mouse dancing on television where he was watching. So, I mean, give us a sense of whether he's reverting back to the pattern of his parents and grandparents, or whether this recent little indication of a change in tone, shall we say, was short-lived.
I think really these are atmospherics, nothing substantive. That is, the young leader's preference for showcasing his bride or Mickey Mouse characters or Sylvester Stallone figures and so forth. These are personal preferences. Optimistic projections of Kim Jong-un, the current leader, doing things differently from his father and grandfather were mostly based on the fact that Kim Jong-un, as a young man, as a teenager, lived in Switzerland for a couple of years. Well, if you consider exposure to European cosmopolitanism as a cure for totalitarianism, one wonders how Pol Pot, the former Cambodian dictator who spent 4 years in Paris in his 20s, or the current Syrian dictator who studied medicine in London as a young man, sat on that kind of transformative experience. These are not the basis under which the North Korean regime operates. For the North Korean regime, nuclear weapons, the capability to one day perhaps marry nuclear a warhead with a long-range missile, those kinds of achievements are really a panacea, cure for North Korea's problems, internal problems, economic problems. And by having that military power to cause problems to the region, the powers, the world's biggest powers, China, the United States, Russia, Japan, South Korea, a middle power admittedly, all these powers have been giving North Korea aid. So it's been a very effective policy. The Chinese signed on to UN Security Council resolutions twice in 2006, once in 2009 in the wake of North Korea's second nuclear test, but in effect, China actually increased trade with North Korea. China increased its aid to North Korea, even after signing on to those UN Security Council resolutions. So from the North Korean point of view, I think, yes, after a period of austerity, the odds are good that China will go back to its old ways and keep giving to North Korea.
Well, but from the Chinese point of view, they don't want the North to collapse and have the U.S. Army on the Yalu River, do they? And I'm surprised that somehow South Korea and the United States can't give China the sufficient assurances? Or is there a division in the Chinese leadership between the military old guard who support the North Koreans and the more outward-looking foreign ministry types?
I think you have to say that as in all vectors of national interest, you can imagine it's conceivable one day, say 10 years now from now, maybe 50 years from now, the Chinese will ultimately grow fed up with North Korea and really pull the plug on North Korea. We know that day has not yet come and will not come for the foreseeable future. The Chinese, yes, are concerned about the prospect of having a unified Korea, a pro-U.S. Korea with perhaps U.S. troops near the border. America and South Koreans really have no intention of posing such direct threat to the Chinese. They have no intention of maintaining U.S. troops along the Yalu River, yet the Chinese are not convinced. The Chinese also worry about the prospect of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of North Korean refugees flooding into China if North Korea were to collapse. And those are legitimate concerns, yes. But at the same time, I think the Chinese see a greater utility in having that North Korea card vis-a-vis the United States in China's long-term strategic competition. It's been a very useful political card for the Chinese because the United States, to a great extent, has relied on China to carry out diplomacy against North Korea vis-a-vis the DPRK on behalf of the United States. The U.S. has asked China to step in, and the Chinese have not been forthright in serving in that role.
Well, just in the last minute, it looks as though there will be a nuclear test in North Korea, and it will be a uranium bomb of a bigger yield than the two previous plutonium bombs. One didn't seem to work, the other one worked fairly well, although it was a very small yield. When do you think this is going to happen? Because it's certainly going to create a tremendous backlash.
Well, one thing, if you even a cursory overview of North Korea's past provocations, they usually coincide on a national holiday. You'll see that the North Koreans have a keen sense of timing. They do things, for instance, on July 4th in the United States. In 2006, they fired off 7 rockets, 1 long-range rocket on July 4th, Eastern Standard, at least, in Washington. They conducted their second nuclear test on May 25th, 2009, for Memorial Day in the United States. They also have a penchant for doing things on a Sunday so as to capture the weekly news cycle, dominate the headlines, thereby put more pressure on their adversaries, Washington, Seoul, and so forth, to respond, to come up with some kind of a response. In that context, doing it before the South Korean presidential inauguration on February 25th, even before one of North Korea's major holidays, February 16th, which is the birthday of Kim Jong-il, the late leader.
Well, I'm afraid we've absolutely run out of time here. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I really have to end here, and I thank you so much for joining us, Sung Yun Lee. Again, Professor of International Affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was